This document, The Life Value Manifesto, synthesizes John McMurtry's economic philosophy and Johann Galtung's sociological frameworks to propose a shift from a money-sequence global war state to a life-coherent system grounded in universal human necessities. And since the submitted material is a profoundly strong, intellectually rigorous synthesis of complex theories, we can jump straight into our critique and focus purely on high-level audience alignment, structure, and practical application.
Yeah, it really is an incredible foundation. Having the integration of life value onto Oxiology, or LVOA, with that piece research it's just really robust. So we have a phenomenal baseline to work from today.
The highly charged terminology used to diagnose the current global economic system, while theoretically precise, risks alienating the specific policymakers and general readers required to enact this systemic change. When I was reading through the opening sections, the material makes a really compelling case for this crisis of global life and coherence, but it uses these incredibly vivid terms.
Right, like the cancer stage of capitalism?
Exactly. Cancer stage of capitalism, the parasitic loop, the pathogenic value code. And I mean, I get why the authors chose these words. They capture the absolute severity of the economic and social degradation we're looking at in section one, but I couldn't help but feel a bit of friction as a reader.
I felt that exact same friction. The diagnosis is clinically accurate within their framework, but I wonder if we fully considered the psychological reality of the person actually reading this document. I mean, they bring up the DMA complex, right? Dichotomy, Manichism, Armageddon.
Yeah, which is a brilliant way to describe that hyper-polarized us versus them mindset.
It really is. It perfectly captures that end-of-the-world mindset driving the war state. But the weakness here, the massive risk, is that by relying on heavily polarized, aggressive metaphors like parasite or cancer, the text might inadvertently trigger that exact same DMA complex in the reader.
Right. It almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. If you frame the current economic and political system as a literal disease, you are pushing your target audience straight into a defensive posture. Because, you know, keep in mind, the target audience here includes the administrators, the economists, the policymakers who are currently operating within that exact system.
They are the gears of that machine.
Right. So if an administrator sits down at their desk on a Tuesday morning and the first thing they read is that their entire professional worldview is a pathogenic value code, their shields are going up immediately. They haven't even gotten to the underlying philosophy of the manifesto yet.
They're just going to perceive the text as an ideological attack.
Exactly, rather than an objective, systemic diagnosis. The goal of this piece is to cure life blindness. But if the initial language feels like an assault, the reader's instinct will be to just reject the premise entirely just to protect their own identity.
That makes total sense, because if you attack their worldview right out of the gate, you lose them before chapter two. So my suggestion here, how we bypass that defensive reflex, is that we need to soften the entry point. A key theme running through this material seems to be the contrast between life-enabling and life-disabling systems. We need to lead with what the reader already intuitively values to build a profound empathetic bridge before we introduce the systemic critique.
I love that approach, grounding the abstract philosophical jargon in the tangible, universal realities of what they call the life ground.
Yes.
Because if we start by establishing a common agreement on the fundamental requirements for human survival and flourishing, the reader is already nodding along with you. And once that baseline is firmly established, introducing the ways the current system fails to meet those requirements, it feels like a shared realization of a problem we all need to solve together.
It stops feeling like a unilateral attack.
Exactly.
Let's brainstorm what that actually looks like on the page, just as one concrete example out of a few possible ways to tackle this. Instead of opening section I with that aggressive framing of the cancer stage, the authors could flip the structure. They define these universal human life necessities beautifully, but they bury them later on in section 2.2.
Oh, they should definitely move that up.
Right. Open the manifesto by painting a vivid, undeniable picture of fundamental needs. You know, clean air, nutritious food, a self-regenerating biosphere, a safe place for a child to sleep. Establish this beautiful, unarguable baseline of what actually allows human thought and action to thrive.
And if you start there, the subsequent introduction of how our current global systems degrade these necessities feels like a tragic departure from a shared ideal. It becomes a mutual problem,
not a political accusation.
Exactly.
That is a much more inviting doorway into the philosophy. And building on that, another place to apply this is when introducing the concept of the civil commons. Right now, the text moves incredibly fast. It jumps straight into the enclosure threat and the pathogenic dismantling of society's immune system. To make this stick, the author should first describe the tangible, everyday reality of the civil commons.
Don't just give us the theory.
Right. Describe a public water treatment plant that works quietly in the background, ensuring an entire city doesn't fall to waterborne disease. Or describe a public school that guarantees literacy for every child in a neighborhood, regardless of their family's income.
Yes, ground the reader in the immense, quiet success of those specific institutions.
Precisely. Because once the reader is anchored in the appreciation of those life-enabling structures, I mean, everyone appreciates clean water and reading, then you apply the LVOA terminology. Then you explain how these structures protect the social host and why the threat of privatization is so dangerous. By the time you introduce the idea of a pathogenic value code, the reader is fiercely protective of that water plant and that school.
Because you made them care about the host before you introduced the parasite.
Exactly.
The direct application of psychological frameworks to highly volatile contemporary geopolitical flashpoints distracts from the timeless, universal applicability of the core philosophy. This brings us right into section 5, where the text performs this deep moral decoding of modern case studies. The authors meticulously decode events like 9/11 and the ongoing conflicts involving the U.S., Israel, and Iran.
It's a fascinating application of the theory.
It really is. They use the CMS syndrome, chosenness, myths, and traumas, and the RP complex, repression and projection, to explain how the new Pearl Harbor catalyzed the modern war state.
It is incredibly detailed. I wonder, though, if the evidence could support a different conclusion about how a reader actually processes this specific information. The weakness here is that jumping straight into these deeply entrenched modern conflicts is incredibly risky. The reader is almost certainly going to fixate entirely on the specific political actors rather than the underlying mechanics of the war state itself.
Because it's just too fresh.
Right. When you invoke 9/11 or you start dissecting the tensions between Washington, Tel Aviv, and Tehran, you are quite literally stepping on the most highly sensitized psychological landmines of the 21st century.
You're right. The visceral noise at the politics just drowns out the philosophy.
Exactly. The reader brings all their own unresolved historical wounds, their national identity, and their pre-existing biases straight to the text. The moment they see those names, their brain switches tracks. That objective moral decoding the text is trying to perform gets completely overshadowed.
The brilliant synthesis of McMurtry and Galting is just lost.
Completely lost? Instead of stepping back to see the overarching architecture of the money sequence global war state, the reader starts silently arguing with the author about the minutiae of Middle Eastern geopolitics. The theory gets hijacked by the headlines.
That's such a critical observation, because the material is desperately trying to elevate the reader to this higher vantage point, to see things from the perspective of planetary solvency. But the gravity of these specific, modern conflicts just pulls the reader right back down into the partisan trenches.
So we need a way to resolve this friction.
Right. So my suggestion here is that we need to fundamentally restructure the narrative flow of these case studies. We have to keep the real-world application without losing the reader to their own political algorithms. The text needs to emphasize the mechanics of structural violence and the destruction of the life ground as the primary, inescapable lens.
And it has to do this before it ever leads with the specific political or national identities of the actors involved.
Exactly. We have to train the audience to see the underlying architecture of the conflict first. If we do that, we bypass their pre-programmed political biases. You force the reader to evaluate the objective disvalue, the actual loss of life capital, through the peer framework of LVOA.
And then, when the geopolitical actors are finally named, the reader is already judging them by the standard of universal life necessities, not by the standard of their own pre-existing political allegiances.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's look closely at how a writer would physically rearrange the text in Section V to achieve this. When discussing the U.S., Israel, and Iran axis, the authors should foreground the invisibility of life concept first. Before mentioning Washington or Tel Aviv or the axis of resistance, the text should highlight the objective reality of the conflict, paint a stark, clinical picture of what is actually happening on the ground.
The destroyed hospitals, the polluted environments.
Yes, the systemic deprivation of basic universal necessities. Describe the collapse of the social host in purely ontological terms.
Make the loss of life the main character of the section.
Exactly. Only after the reader has fully registered this catastrophic loss of life, capital, only after they feel the weight of that destroyed hospital, should the text drop in the specific geopolitical actors.
You force the reader to confront the reality of the LVA framework before their political defense mechanisms have a chance to activate. That is such a smart way to reposition the argument. To give another concrete application of this, look at how the text frames the targeting of infrastructure.
Right, in places like Iraq or Gaza?
Yeah. The text should explicitly frame the targeting of power grids and water treatment plants as a deliberate decoding of a society's will to resist. Introduce this through Galton's framework of structural violence first. Take the time to describe the mechanics of a Death Star starvation environment. Walk the reader through what happens to a community when a water filtration plant goes offline.
Make sure the reader evaluates that deliberate destruction through the lens of generational life capital loss.
Exactly. Because once they deeply understand the mechanics of how a war state dismantles the civil commons to force submission, the specific historical examples, whether it's in the Middle East or anywhere else, simply become proof of the theory. They cease to be the primary subject of debate. The focus remains locked exactly where the authors want it, which is on the universal applicability of the philosophy.
The visionary solutions proposed for transitioning to a life-coherent system remain largely abstract and would be significantly strengthened by integrating the practical diagnostic tools currently isolated at the end of the document. Let's move into the solutions section, Section V. Conceptually, this section is a masterpiece. It asks humanity to make this massive leap from strategic deterrent to universal life security.
It relies heavily on an evolution of consciousness to reclaim the civil commons.
Yes, and the text does a masterful job visualizing a future where the global labor force transitions from death work to life work. It's a beautiful vision. But as I was reading it, I found myself thinking, this feels a bit unbalanced against the weight of the problem they just diagnosed.
I had a similar reaction. Is the connection between this profound philosophical awakening and the actual mechanical reality of global governance fully established? The weakness in Section VI is that, while the transition to planetary solvency is conceptually fascinating, it lacks structural stepping stones. The proposed solution relies so heavily on a collective philosophical awakening that it inevitably feels a bit utopian.
It feels especially abstract when you pit it against the deeply entrenched, highly urbanized, mathematically precise military-industrial money sequence that was diagnosed in the first half of the document.
Right, because the war state isn't just an idea. It's a machine.
It is a machine. The pathogenic system the authors are critiquing has metrics. It has dashboards, quarterly reports, logistics chains, and budget committees. By contrast, the solution presented in the core text feels largely theoretical. Think about that policymaker we talked about earlier. If they read Section 6, they might agree entirely with the need for universal life security, but they will close the document and ask, okay, but what exactly do I do when I walk into my office on Monday morning?
The manifesto diagnoses the illness with absolute clinical precision, but the prescription in the main body of the text reads more like a philosophy of wellness rather than a strict medical regimen.
So my suggestion is that we need to ground these visionary ideas. How do we give this section the administrative teeth it needs to actually challenge the war state? The great news here is that the authors have already done the hard work.
They just hit it.
They hit it. Our suggestion is to elevate the highly practical, actionable frameworks that are currently relegated to the appendices and embed them directly into the core solution section.
Pull those diagnostic tools and comparative tables out of the back of the document and place them front and center in the climax of the manifesto. By doing that, you provide administrators with an immediate, tangible roadmap.
You instantly transform the evolution of consciousness from a spiritual or philosophical concept into a rigorous, measurable administrative process.
I love this because it's such a simple structural fix, but it completely changes the reading experience.
Let's break down how this integration physically changes the text.
As an example, the authors have a brilliant table in Appendix B called the life value metric versus the money sequence metric. Policymakers love a good spreadsheet. Instead of leaving this at the very end of the document where half the readers might miss it, move this table directly into section 6.1.
When the text discusses moving from strategic deterrence to universal life security, use this exact table to explicitly demonstrate how a government could practically measure this shift.
Walk them through the math.
Exactly. Show the reader exactly how to calculate the success of transferring funds from a multi-billion dollar weapon system to a regional water filtration plant. Use the table to prove with hard metrics that by shifting the indicator of growth from GDP to the health of the civil commons, a nation's true security profile actually increases.
That one move takes the abstract concept of universal life security and gives it a hard, undeniable administrative metric.
That is exactly the kind of concrete structural change that bridges the gap between theory and practice. And there's another perfect opportunity for this. The authors should integrate Appendix A, the master map of systemic regulation, directly into Section 6.3.
When the text talks about recovering and strengthening the civil commons, don't just leave it as a theoretical ideal floating in the air.
Show the reader the master map. Show them the exact five-stage evolutionary trajectory. Let them see the progression from simple biological homeostasis, moving through allostasis and sustainability, all the way to the ultimate grand goal of planetary solvency.
It makes it feel possible.
Yes. By embedding this map in the core text, you give the reader a clear, multi-stage blueprint for how the global labor force can systematically transition away from the cancer stage of capitalism. It proves to the administrator reading it that LVOA isn't just an academic critique. It is a fully functional operating system that is ready to be deployed right now.
As we draw this critique to a close, let's briefly recap the three main areas of focus we've explored today. First, we looked at the necessity of adjusting the aggressive, highly charged diagnostic terminology to better align with the audience by softening terms like the cancer stage of capitalism and leading with shared values. We ensure policymakers aren't pushed into a defensive posture before they can absorb the philosophy.
Second, we discussed refocusing the modern, highly volatile case studies to prioritize the mechanics of structural violence over specific political identities. This ensures the core philosophy isn't lost in the visceral noise of contemporary geopolitical biases.
Finally, we explored the critical need to integrate the practical, actionable frameworks currently sitting in the appendices directly into the main solution section, making the transition to planetary solvency a tangible reality for administrators.
To summarize the actual steps for the revision, ground the LVOA framework in tangible, universal life necessities early on to build an empathetic bridge with your reader. When you get to the case studies in Section 5, restructure them to lead with the objective disvalue of destroyed infrastructure before naming the political actors, which will neutralize the reader's pre-programmed defensive scripts.
And finally, elevate the master map and the life value metric table from the appendices straight into Section 6. That will provide the hard, measurable roadmap needed for replacing the money sequence with a life-coherent economy.
Grounding this profound philosophical work in these tangible administrative realities is going to drastically amplify the manifesto's impact and usability.
A depth of thought in this manifesto is truly remarkable, and it provides a vital, necessary lens for understanding our current global paradigm. We warmly invite the listener to implement these structural shifts, refine the entry points of these powerful concepts, and submit their revised work back in for further exploration.